Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. Adam E. Coffey is the author of three bestsellers, The Private Equity Playbook, The Exit Strategy Playbook, and Empire Builder, The Road to a Billion. After 10 years as an executive at General Electric, he was hired as the president of three private equity-backed service companies, where he completed 58 acquisitions and facilitated billions of dollars in successful exits. Today's conversation is structured as like a contractor's guide to the private equity playbook. In other words, what can we in our small businesses learn from the masters of big businesses? A lot, it turns out. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Adam. He really knows his stuff. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Adam Coffey, thank you for coming on Contractor Evolution. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to be here. Hello to all your listeners out there. Let's do this, man. Let's have some fun.
So for the unacquainted listener, maybe hasn't read your books, isn't familiar with you, I'm going to let you do a bit of an intro on yourself. Talk about your career, your books, your advisory, like what you're up to now. Just paint a picture for everyone.
Happy to. So listen, you know, life is a set of experiences, I think, for us all. I'm 60 now, but I still look out the eyes of a young man. But if I look back on my life, you know, I'm a veteran, served in the U.S. Army as a, you know, early, right out of high school, you know, enlisted guy, you know, made the rank of sergeant, you know, while I was in the service. So I tell you, military taught me something about discipline, teamwork, leadership. And then an engineering career followed after that. Engineering made me a meticulous planner. I'm a pilot. Pilots don't take off unless we know where we're going. And then we deconstruct the trip. Very useful skill later on in life when I was building companies. I then spent 10 years at GE. This is before tech. So General Electric is number one on the Fortune 500 list. Jack Welch, world's most admired CEO. Great place for an up and coming young executive to learn how to run a business. And I then spent 21 years building three different national service companies for nine different private equity firms. A turnaround guy from my GE days. So what I started with usually wasn't working really well when I got there. And then ultimately a buy and build guy, which, you know, I bought 58 companies and sprinkled them on top of the platforms or the companies that I was building. $2.5 billion in exits under my belt. And I got bored. I got bored running one company, building one company at a time. I wanted to impact many. I had been speaking at the university level in executive MBA programs for 15 years at UCLA. That led me to writing my first book, you know, and so it's like I loved mentoring and coaching, you know, younger up and coming future executives. And so I hung up my CEO cleats about 3 years ago and said, done being a CEO. And now I serve three verticals. So I work with about a dozen private equity firms. I help them evaluate investments. I coach and mentor their CEOs. I work with 71 founders in a bunch of different industries. Some are in a peer group and some, you know, I focus on one-on-one, helping entrepreneurs learn how to succeed. It really is my main focus today. And then I still teach seminars globally. I write books and I'm having a lot of fun. You know, I'm 60. And I work more hours today than I've ever worked before in my career. I have clients all over the globe. You know, I literally am doing calls at night with my clients in Australia the next day. You know, my European crowd, I've got some Saturday morning clients. It's like, I'm just, you know, I'm having fun. So it's not really work, but I'm working more hours than I ever did. So, you know, it's, I guess I'm having fun.
My dad calls it staying relevant.
Yes.
Yeah. It's good. It's awesome, man. And tell us about the books.
Yeah, so I've written four books. They've all been number one bestsellers. This morning, my first book, The Private Equity Playbook, was number one on Amazon in private equity. Empire Builder was number one as an audio book this morning. That was my third book. But really, if I think of them in terms of, think of like the Star Wars saga.
Yeah.
You know, they started with episodes 4, 5, and 6 and then went back and did 1, 2, and 3. If I think of my books, how I would recommend people read them is to start with Empire Builder, which was my third book. But read it first because it's the roadmap to building a company and building the empire. And then Exit Strategy, my second book, read it second because it then helps you position yourself for exit. And then thirdly, read my first book, which was The Private Equity Playbook, now available in a second edition, which is updated. And read that one because there's better than 50% chance that if you sell your business in today's world, you're going to sell it to a private equity firm or a private equity-backed strategic. And so you need to learn about what private equity is and how it works so that you can take advantage of the opportunities that it avails to you so that you can take advantage and make a ton of money. And so that's how I think about my books. A couple of them are subject, you know, specific. You know, one of them is more general. That's Empire Builder. This is how we build an empire.
Yeah. That's good news because that is the order that I went in just by happenstance. And I have sort of pulled a few, I've cherry picked, I think like sections or ideas or themes from each that I think are super, super relevant for our listeners. And so I'm going to dive right in here. In Empire Builder, there is a section near in the first half of the book where you kind of talk in quite a lot of detail about the various stages of growth, and you break them up into three brackets. And I'm sure that these aren't necessarily like perfect delineations in reality, but they're useful brackets to play around with when we're thinking. And you kind of go 0 to 1, 1 to 10, 10 to 100, stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, and there was this line on the book in stage, when you're talking about stage 1, that really just like jumped off the page for me. You say, to successfully build a big business, you need to build a small one first. And I just like really simple, clear, you know, anecdotes and messages and ideas like that. And I wanted to ask you about it. Like, why is that something you put in there? Did people try and skip that step?
So these are great questions, great concepts. Let me give a little context. So there's 33 million small businesses just in this country, in the United States. They represent 99.9% of all businesses in the country. They employ half of the country's workforce. But only 7% ever get to $1 million in revenue. And of those that get to $1 million, only 4% ever get to $10 million. And so when I started thinking about Empire Builder and peeling back the layers of the onion and teaching people how to be successful, you know, I started with the premise of, why is it so hard to be successful? Why do so many few entrepreneurs ever get to $1 million, let alone 10? There's only 3,000 companies on the planet that have $1 billion in revenue. So 34 million small guys, you know, of which only 7% get to $1 million. Why is it so damn hard? What are they doing wrong? Mm. And so breaking it down, when I think about 0 to $1 million, and guys and ladies out there, you got to remember, I'm a guy who's held every job you can hold on an org chart. I started my career as a technician, a dude in a truck.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, it's the basics. You know, you have to build a successful small company first. If you don't, so many entrepreneurs tell me, Adam, I'll figure out how to make money later when I get bigger, when I scale. And I'm like, no, that's the wrong answer. Look, if you're a landscape maintenance company, as an example, which is the example I use in the book Empire Builder, profitability, you're going to live or die by one truck. You may have 100 someday down the road, but let's talk about unit level economics. Let's talk about, how do I build the perfect big business? I start by building the perfect small business. So if I've got a landscape crew, I got two guys in a truck, you know, two people in a truck. How much revenue can they produce? How many lawns can they cut? You know, and what are the costs to operate that truck, pay their salaries, give them benefits? what's my basic profit margin? And I talk in the book about this thing I call the 30-20-10 rule. My perfect little business generates at least a 30% gross profit, and it's got less than 20% SG&A or back office costs or customer acquisition costs, whatever you want to call it. And it must make at least a dime on a dollar in order to be scalable. Now, as I get bigger, you know, I can certainly improve my profitability, but I want to start from the premise of unit level economics. What's my unit level economics for a landscape maintenance business? It's one truck, it's one crew. How many lawns? What's the revenue they produce? Does it cover the direct operating expense of cutting those lawns and earning that revenue? Does it then give me at least 30% gross profit? Does it cover the less than 20% to find a customer, to run the back office? Do I make at least a dime on a dollar? If I do, I can now build a simple economic formula. What's my revenue per truck? How many trucks does it take to get to $1 million in revenue? 1 million divided by the number, you know, the revenue per truck tells me I need to have, you know, 5.2 trucks on the road. Well, I can't hire and buy 0.2 of a crew and a truck. And so I need six trucks cutting a certain number of lawns at a certain dollar amount in order to generate enough revenue to cover the direct operating costs, leave me 30% gross profit. And so this is what I try to teach people how to do, is how to take something that appears to be complex on the surface and break it down into a simple economic formula, you know, first around revenue, you know, and earnings, but then again, another formula for capital expenditure. So to build a $1 million landscape maintenance business, I have to buy six trucks. What are six trucks going to cost me? I have to buy six mowers. I have to buy six blowers. You know, and so it's build the capital expenditure plan, build the revenue plan. And so on the road to a million, perfect my unit level economics. Mm. And if I can build it successfully small, then what I've got literally could be scalable all the way to $1 billion. If it doesn't work small, it won't work big. And it's less risk if I perfect that formula small. And if I can't make it work small, I'd rather walk away small than waste 20 years of my life trying to build something to be successful that'll never get there.
So, but Adam, people make this mistake all the time. You would see it more than I do. I'm curious if you just have a perspective on why people want to skip that step. Is it ego? Is it hubris? Do they get too excited? Is it just naivete?
I think it's naivete. I just think they don't understand. They don't understand what is the important part, how they think volume. Mm. Everybody thinks volume. Look, I'm not going to make money small because I can't. You know, I need a bunch of stuff. I need a bunch of customers, bunch of trucks, and then figure it out. And I just think it's wrong. Yeah. It's just they're uninformed, and it's naivete. And so it's not that they skip it because they don't think it's important. They don't realize that the key to the success of the big business is making sure that it works as a small business.
Mm-hmm. I love your comment too about simplicity. I had a mentor say this to me years ago, and it's always really clicked for me, which is there's almost nothing in the small business world that isn't napkin math. Like pretty much everything is really, really simple grade 10, grade 8 math. Now, you want to get into really advanced pivot tables for pricing models. You want to get into complex investing. There is sort of an upper tranche or a tier where things get complex. But for the small business environment and the businesses that we talk to and work with in this world, most of it is like, okay, how much does a truck make? How much do I need to pay to get that truck going? How many trucks to a million? Like it's very, very simple. And I like framing things in that way because it cleans up your thinking. It makes it more hygienic, and the answers jump out at you faster when you don't overcomplicate the math.
Well, and let's just recognize wealth does not come from being a W-2 employee working for somebody else. And so the backbone of wealth creation has always been small business and small business owners who figure it out and become bigger business owners who then somewhere down the road monetize it. And so you and I are talking about napkin math, and I'm doing it because, you know, I've made every mistake a guy can make in a book across a career. And so I've learned, and I'm trying to share that experience. But you know, a lot of these people who became very wealthy, you know, they weren't PhDs in business. And so how did they find success? They did these things without actually recognizing that they were doing them. And so all I'm pointing out is just the common sense lessons learned across decades of building companies and putting it in a framework that they easily grasp and understand, but also just driving home the point of how important it is in the early stages. You know, I recently was working with a billionaire who has a really, really large service company, and it's kind of lost its way. And you know, CEOs are just failing at trying to fix this thing. And I'm like, you know, it's like, why are they failing? And it's like, they're failing because they're trying to fix it from the top down and they're missing the boat. I don't have to fix 6,000 trucks. I just need to fix one. Let's peel back the layers of the onion. Let's go back to just the basic unit level economics. Are we generating enough revenue per truck to cover the crew that's inside and their training and the tools and, you know, and their salaries and their benefits? And are we generating enough gross profit to support the back office? And it's like, and we weren't passing the basic fundamentals. And I'm like, I don't care how big this business is. You know, this is just a classic example of the unit level, you know, unit level economics don't work, you know, and we need to fix them. So do it small, do it early. And you're going to be that business that beats the odds, that gets to a million, that gets to a 10 million, you know, and potentially to 100 million.
Stage two is 1 to 10 million, which is where most of our listeners are going to be. If stage one is all about those unit economics, what is this mid zone about, this 1 to 10 zone about?
I look at 0 to a million as perfecting the unit level economics, really getting them dialed in. So when I started the business, if I started it from scratch and I had no idea, you know, I had an estimate of what those unit level economics, I had an estimate of what I think revenue I could generate. Well, on the road to a million, I'm kind of perfecting, I'm learning, I'm monkeying with my formula and I'm getting it dialed in. And so therefore, you know, once I've got to a million, I've beat the odds. I'm one of 7% of businesses that hit the million. Now to get to the 4% of those that get to 10 million, it's really about replicating the unit level economics. So I now have an economic formula that's viable. I have it for both revenue generation and I have it for capital expenditure, you know, trucks I'm buying, things I need to invest in. And now I literally take that same napkin math that we just did. And I said, I now know what my revenue per truck is, you know, and the 30-20-10 rule's been applied. How many trucks do I need on the road to get to 10 million? 10 million divided by revenue per truck, you know, that got me to work at a million. I now know I'm gonna go from 5 or 6 trucks to 50 trucks. You know, I can now do that math. But there's a little bit more magic now. So as I'm scaling, I should be actually improving my cost structure. So my revenue is growing at one pace. My expense curve should be growing at another. Let me give you the example around trucks. Look, if I'm going to buy 50 trucks, I'm going to get a better price than if I buy one truck. And so everything I do, if I'm buying 30 commercial mowers instead of one commercial mower, you know, I'm going to leverage all my suppliers to get better pricing. And I'm going to be, you know, as I'm building brand name recognition in my initial market that I'm serving, you know, I should be able to build a $1 million company in any market. I should be able to build a $10 million company. And I'd say 99% of the markets that are out there. And so as I'm getting bigger, I'm getting brand awareness. My cost to advertise, my cost for customer acquisition should be becoming more efficient. My back office cost should be becoming more streamlined. And so I should actually become more profitable on the way from 1 million to 10 million. And if I'm not, I'm missing the boat somewhere still. And so I'm still perfecting the formula. But if it's 30, 20, 10 at a million, it might be, you know, 30 20 or 30, 18 and 12, you know, or, you know, and so my profitability should start increasing as I'm building scale. That's called operating leverage. So as I'm getting bigger, I should become more efficient. And in doing so, my profitability actually goes up. That's why we start with the basic 30, 20, 10. I got to make a dime on a dollar to be viable, but I want more than a dime on a dollar. You know, a great landscaping company probably has plus 30%, over 30% gross profit margin, and they're probably 15% or less on SG&A. And, you know, as a result of that, they're 15 to 20% on the net profit side. And so I should be getting more profitable as I'm getting bigger. This now is freeing and creating more capital that I can now reinvest and potentially start thinking about strategic pivots and how I'm going to get, you know, so we've been talking about landscape maintenance. So let's go back. You know, so my basic crew concept was I'm going to cut somebody's lawn and I'm going to cut a lot of lawns in one neighborhood because that's more efficient than having to drive all over the place to get from one job to the next. But since I am cutting your lawn, would you like your beds remulched? Would you like me to work on your irrigation system? Maybe I add services for landscape lighting services. Maybe during the holidays, I start doing holiday lighting, you know, and so I start adding ancillary products and services on that road to 10 million. Because the hardest thing for us to do in any business, don't care what industry, is to get a customer. Once we've got a customer, what else can we sell them? You know, and can I get more wallet share out of that customer? And so I could give you examples all day long about industries and how we do that.
Well, but I do want to get into that, but I want to back up and ask you, push back on something you're saying. Like you're like, hey, the scale should get better. The profit margin should get better as you grow. Our observed reality here at Breakthrough Academy, which is our advising business for construction and trades business, is that is often, in reality, that is often not the case. So let me tell you a few situations that we see a lot, and then I want you to tell me your take on maybe why that's happening or what the root causes are. So in this $1 to $10 million zone, here's what we see all the time. People don't anticipate the investment required in terms of CapEx and overhead to get from, let's say, 2 million to 5 million or 4 million to 6 million. And they sort of underestimate the spend needed and they get into some cash crunch situations. Another one that's really common is they just like, they maybe get a little ahead of themselves in terms of their own leadership capacity. They say, go, holy, running, you know, a team of 50 is a lot harder than running a team of 10. I'm now installing management layers. I don't really know how to do that. I'm just running a bigger business that I'm personally not built for yet, or are there skill gaps on? And then another one would just be that the profitability thing, just for mysterious reasons, often they don't understand themselves, just evaporates. And you'll literally, you've probably heard them say this, Adam. I was, you know, when I was doing $1 million a year, I was making so much money. Now that we're doing five, I'm making the same or less. You know, it's a bit of a head scratcher. So I'm chucking a lot at you here, but maybe to simplify the question, it's like in this 1 to 10 zone, when you see people fail or get really stagnated or just struggle through it, what mistakes generally are they making?
So let's start by just recognizing we're talking about a problem that I'm going to call is in the margins. So I bought 58 companies. Most of the companies I bought, I'd say the entrepreneur hit 20 to 30 million in revenue and they kind of tapped out. You know, that there's no more bandwidth. You know, what made them successful going from zero to a million was they're an anal retentive control freak, you know, literally making sure everything was uniform and done the same way. And that's what was required, was that kind of discipline in order to be successful early and out of the gates. And we all as leaders, as entrepreneurs, get to some point to where we just run out of bandwidth. We become our own bottleneck. We become our own worst enemy because too many of the decisions have to flow through us and we no longer have bandwidth. We can no longer service for growth. But you're talking to a guy who's built billion-dollar businesses. And so there are different points, you know, where you're facing these bottlenecks And investments are required. Investments are always required, you know, in order to grow the business to the next level. And so recognizing, what I call it is the entrepreneur needs to find their gear shift. And so when we're early starting out, we manage minutia and we are managing on a shoestring, you know, keeping everything as lean as possible. We recognize somewhere on the road from a million to 10, we need some infrastructure, you know, and we're going to need some there in order to handle those 50 employees or those 50 trucks. And this is a new expense layer that we haven't had before. And so, yes, you could see profitability start to drop off. But if I'm adding ancillary revenue streams, if I'm maximizing price potential, you know, if I am doing some of these other things, you know, and I also call it, you know, when it comes to SG&A back office, I have to earn back office. I earn back office with revenue growth. So, you know, revenue I charge, you know, I'll tell you, is one of my biggest levers for growth in any company I work with. You know, I walk into a company and lo and behold, it's like people think they're charging, you know, the market price. And I find out that how they price is completely wrong. Mm. You know, they're looking at their expenses, so common, and they add a markup on top of their expenses, which creates an artificial ceiling to how much profit they can make. And, you know, I was speaking at a roofing conference not too long ago with a bunch of roofing companies. And I'm like, is there anybody out there who thinks if we added $1 to every bid we put out, we would have lost any bids? And they kind of laughed. They thought I was joking. And I'm like, no, okay, well, then there's still price available on the table. We want to find the price that drives, you know, the point where if I add one more dollar, customer says no. If we can find that place, my profitability, my gross profit is probably much higher than 30%. Mm. You know, and I'm now generating more profit to invest in this infrastructure that I'm going to need. But I find most entrepreneurs top out 20 or 30 million. They run out of bandwidth. And what they need to do is learn how to shift from being a manager of minutia to becoming a manager of process and to start hiring a management layer and empowering them and trusting them to be able to make decisions in their absence, pushing decisions down to the lowest level to where they need to be made so that the organization can become more nimble in terms of servicing growth. And so it's a common problem when we start, we have no infrastructure. Once we find some success, we now start to need infrastructure. And so we're making these investments, which makes them to say, that's what's driving my profitability down. But I'm not building a $10 million company. I'm building a $100 million company. And so I need to learn how to make investments as I'm driving revenue increases and profitability increases so that the revenue curve is essentially going up. The expense curve is also going up, but it's going up at a lower pace than revenue. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if I do that, the difference between the two curves, both are going up. I'm spending more money on expenses. You know, so as a percent of revenue, though, they should be going down. Mm. And that wedge in between revenue and expense is what's called operating margin. And that's my increased profitability. And if I want to sell this business someday, I have to be able to demonstrate that as I'm growing it, I'm becoming more efficient. And I use cost as the example because it's the easiest one for people to grasp. But I should also be maximizing my profit by driving my revenue higher, by adding ancillary revenue streams that are at a higher margin because I'm now doing more work at a customer's location. I have efficiencies built in. I'm getting bigger and building density. So instead of doing one lawn in a neighborhood, I'm doing 20 lawns in a neighborhood or what have you. And so it's like, I need to be smart about how I'm planning for all this growth so that I can pull this off.
We got to keep moving, but you had said something that I just think is kind of important, and I do want to just go back to it. You said you have to earn your SG&A. You have to like earn your overhead spend, and I think that there's something kind of what does that mean? What are you saying when you say that?
So people look at you know, I need infrastructure, and so I add infrastructure. And it's a rocky road. When I'm a small business, I add a person and my expenses, like it's like a step stairs. They go up, you know, as I'm adding things. And what I like to tell people is we have to earn. We have to always be on the thin side of infrastructure you know, we need to make our investments in direct cost, you know, our trucks, our people that are doing the work that we're doing. We support them with revenue. The basic formula is working. But as my revenue is going up, my gross profit dollars are going up. Now, by applying the 30-20-10 rule, I'm saying to myself, okay, now that my revenue is up, you know, call it 100,000, and therefore I'm up 30,000 in gross profit, and I want my expenses to be 20,000 or less, I've just earned $20,000 and I've put it in a piggy bank. And as revenue is growing and gross profit, you know, dollars are being contributed, I'm siphoning off a portion of those dollars and I'm building them into a piggy bank. And I'm saying, okay, I went up a million in revenue and that earned me 300,000 in gross profit, which if my SG&A is 20% or less, that earned me 200,000 now that I can go spend on infrastructure. So I should lead with revenue growth. I should lag with infrastructure expense. I have to earn those infrastructure dollars and I have to be judicious. So I always think about it in terms of, okay, if I doubled the company in size, you know, what would I need in the back office? And what are the jobs? What are the people? What are the costs? Let's prioritize them in rank order. And let's always have kind of a on the whiteboard, I got a wish list. I wish I had a director of this, you know, or a dispatch manager, or I wish I had a marketing manager. I don't add them until I earn them. And so I force myself to stay on the lean side of the back office expense until the revenue growth and gross profit dollars growth has put enough money in the piggy bank for me to now prioritize and say, I've got enough money in that piggy bank, time for me to spend. I'm going to make the investment in this role and add that to my infrastructure. And so that's how I think about adding expense.
It's so well said. And I wanted to kind of dig that point out because we unfortunately see the opposite happen a lot in our world, which is there's a lot of hiring decisions or infrastructure decisions that are made very much off of like, this is going to sound strong, but it's almost like feeling sorry for yourself. It's like, we're so freaking busy. We need a production manager, a second production manager, or a marketing manager. And you sort of add these overhead roles, which, you know, theoretically like help the business and you're adding layers, but they're not like directly revenue generating roles. They're leading revenue generating roles, or in some cases they're not. And what the situation, we have a name for it at BT, I don't think it's uniquely ours, is just you have a bloated overhead. Like there's too many people here that are not either digging the ditch or selling the ditch. This is a problem. And so really, really well said. Let's move on to stage three, 10 to 100 million. Very, very briefly, we don't need to spend forever on this, but like just how does the playbook open up there? And what are the main focuses for businesses beyond that last tier?
Yeah. So generally I lay out the framework, perfect it at a million, scale it to 10. And once I hit a million, I start an ancillary revenue stream. As one is going to 10, something's going from zero to one, you know, and I'm kind of using this format to add products and services, learn my unit level economics and start growing the business. I can usually get to 10 million. Look, I'm in Dallas, you know, so in Dallas, I could get to 10 million, no problem. But if we're talking 10 to 100 now, there's a more than high probability and likelihood that I'm going to have to expand my business now into new cities, into new markets. You know, I'll call them new MSAs. I'm here in Texas, so I'm in the Dallas-Fort Worth MSA. Maybe I'm going down to Houston, you know, because Houston's another giant market that's 5 hours away. Maybe I'm going to San Antonio. Maybe I'm going up to Oklahoma City. It's like, I'm going to have to take the magic that I created in one market, and I'm now going to have to become a multi-market company. And so I go into a new territory. I can do this two ways. I can either do it, you know, de novo, you know, greenfield organically, hire a person, buy a building, you know, buy my first five or six trucks to get me to a million in that city, you know, and I can build it from scratch. And I recommend people, you know, do some of that, or I can buy it. I might go find another landscape maintenance company that already has customers, that already has revenue, already has trucks on the road, and I'll pay fair market value for that company. And now I've gone from zero to, some kind of a multi-million dollar revenue stream, and I've bought it. And so by buying it, I have eliminated the startup risk of the new territory. And I've also, kind of bought a business that has proven it can beat the odds, but it's a time accelerator, and time's the one thing that we can't buy more of. I don't care how much money you have. I can't buy time. We're going to get older. Our business is going to mature. We don't want to screw around with organic growth from 0 to 100 million. That takes a really long time. I can juice up my growth rates by buying other businesses that look like me, making them a part of my stable of companies, integrating them, and taking some of what I've learned about unit level economics, about other ancillary products or revenues and streams, and I can cross-pollinate that now into new markets. If I'm a commercial business doing commercial service, my customers may bring me into other markets. And so as I think about what markets to go to, I think about who is my customer. If I'm residential home service, that's not as big an issue because, it's a homeowner. But if I'm a commercial company, maybe I'm looking at my big logo customers and where else do they do business? And that might guide me to a new market. So different ways to do it. But, I like to do both. I like to do both, do organic, let's open up, but then let's also be looking for opportunities to buy other businesses that are like us. When I buy 58 companies and put them together, the growth that happens in the time period is massive growth in a very short time period. And with that massive growth, provided I buy good companies run by good people and I learn how to integrate them, it really helps too from that cost perspective, because I'm now leveraging, I'll call it a more efficient back office. I buy 5 landscape maintenance companies. Well, they got 5 dispatchers. They've got, coordinators. It's like the 5 HR departments. They got 5 people doing accounting. It's like I can become a much more efficient back office, and I now become highly scalable. And that expense curve, I get synergies out of these businesses that I'm buying. So as we get bigger, again, we should be able to find increased profitability, and I can buy it on the road to 100, or I can build it. Ideally, we want to do both.
This geographic expansion thing, I want to just ask you about quickly, because it occurs to me that a lot of people do this earlier than they need to. I've had a few guests on the show talk about this whole idea of, if you can't, operate a business down the street, forget about operating a business, 4 hours away. It's hard. It is not easy to sort of spread yourself that thin. You're now,
especially if you're still a control freak.
So yeah. I love your take on this. Like, what are the signals, the green lights that an entrepreneur is getting from their own business, from their own market or customers, that says, hey, it's time to move to, it's time to move down the road to Houston or Oklahoma City? And then maybe at the same time, what are some of the red lights, even yellow lights? Like, how does somebody like make a decision like that? Because it's a big, big decision. I'm not saying it's an irreversible door. It's not like you couldn't come back from it, but you probably don't want to. So you got to be sure. And I'm just wondering how you would think about that.
Yeah. So do I have an ongoing concern? That's my first, question. So what does that mean? A lot of times I'll run these, I call them stress tests. Have you ever watched Bar Rescue? And they'll bring in a bunch of customers into a bad run bar and just see them crash. I tell an entrepreneur, you think you got a good business? I want you to go on vacation for 2 weeks. I want you to not answer the phone. I want you to not look at email. And when you come back, will you still have a business? Will it still be generating revenue while you're gone? Will it be producing profit? Will there be deposits being made in the bank? It's like, well, everything, the train's still running on time. If you can answer yes, you're ready to think about expansion. If your answer is no, you are not ready for that expansion. You're just not. And so you don't have the proper infrastructure that can scale. So listen, I've built big, large national companies. My last company, we had like 80 branch offices. I got to have 80 branch managers. I got to have people that I trust. I can't micromanage that. I have to have a structure in place. So to go from small to really big, The first key is did I build the first market to where it can run without me? Some people might take offense to that. Oh my God, that would be sacrilegious that my company could exist without me. Listen, if you're so important to your business that it grinds to a halt to, when you're gone, you don't have a sellable business. You don't have an ongoing concern that can run without you. It's like we need to build an ability for our organization to think and to continue in our absence. And if we can pull that off, that vacation test, we're ready to think about a second market. If you talk to successful entrepreneurs who built regional or national companies, and you say, how did you find the new market? A lot of them will tell you, look, I grew with my customers. I was doing commercial this or that, with property management, and my customer was, I was doing business for them in one market. And they're like, boy, I love what you do for me. I wish you could do it in this other market. And a lot of people grew with their customers, And so on the commercial side, residential side, it's a little bit different. Sometimes then it's driven by our suppliers. Hey, you're the dealer for this brand in this market and you're killing it. And I got another guy in another market and they're not killing it or they're retiring. And it's like, I'd love to have you come to this market. And so sometimes it's done by our dealers, or distributorships. Sometimes it's done by our customers. But what essentially is taking place is it's a business that's learned how to be an ongoing concern that can operate without its owner, which now frees the owner up to focus on growth and to think strategically about what markets do I go to next and what kind of strategy am I going to have? I put a lot of science into this. My last company, we literally hired data scientists to take a look at our business. Here's my top 100 logos. These are the markets I'm currently serving. I want you to go out across the country, map out where all of my customers have all their other locations. We were a commercial company. And I want you to highlight those MSAs or metropolitan markets where I've got the highest concentration of existing customer facilities that I'm not servicing because I'm not there. Then I want you to add macroeconomic data that says these are our markets where people are moving in, not moving out, where the economy is growing, not shrinking. Combine economic data with my own individual customer data. Tell me where are the 10 best markets I should consider going to. And then once I have that list, now I'm going to my clients and I'm pre-priming the pump, on where it is I'm going to go. And I use a strategy around where I go and, where I go next, what markets to focus on. But commonly, it's just our customers who drag us there, or we're a distributor or representing a product. I'm an HVAC company, I'm a carrier dealer. It's like, and they need a carrier dealer in another city or, whatever the case may be. It's like something, because I'm good, I get opportunity. And the more strategy I can put around that, and the more I focus on getting good in my market. And so a lot of people, I call it entrepreneurial schizophrenia. They're so busy being busy. They got so many ideas for growth. They're doing 50 things at once and they're doing none of them well. Stick to your core, core product or service. Tend to your knitting. Get really good at doing what you do in the market you're at. Start thinking about pivots and extra revenue streams. As you're building those, you're building the infrastructure. Can you step away? Yes. Where do I go next? Let's think about strategy.
In the book, there's a section and it's titled, I put it in bold on my little roadmap here. It's 4 powerful organic levers to bend your growth curve upward. What does that term, particularly I'm talking about the bend your growth curve upward, mean in the context of private equity growth?
Yeah. So a lot of entrepreneurs, when we sell our businesses, they're growing, they've grown. But they're not lighting the world on fire. We may be we're growing in double digits. I got 10% growth. I got 12% growth. Keep in mind, we're not a startup. We didn't go from $1 revenue to 2 and say we got 100% growth. We've been around the block a while. Every company I went in to run had been in business for 40 years before I got there. Mature company, mature industry, and they're growing, but they're not setting the world on fire. In the world, in context of private equity, we need about a 30% growth rate in earnings. Not in revenue. Revenue doesn't matter, people. Earnings matter. I'd rather have, You know, so compare two construction companies. I have a $100 million construction company that earns $5 million, or I have a $20 million construction company that earns $5 million. That second company is worth a lot more than the first. You know, it's not about revenue, people. It's about earnings. You know, and so, you know, when I think about growth, it's growth of earnings. And I'm looking for about 30%. And if I can grow it, if I grow it 10%, it takes 7.2 years to double my company in size. Well, if I've got a $1 million business, it's going to take me a hell of a long time to get to 10 million. You know, and I'm going to be an old man before I get there. So I need to juice up my returns. I need to juice up my growth rate. If I can get to 30%, that company doubles in size in 2.8 years. It triples in size in 4.2. It quadruples in just over 5. That's sexy growth. Every company I went into to run was growing at less than 10%, had been that way for years, and I got them all to grow at 30%. Now, when we sell our companies, entrepreneurs usually tell the owner, magically, after you give me a bunch of gold, this company's going to grow like a weed like it's never grown before. And what I tell entrepreneurs is, as a buyer and a guy who works with buyers every day, I don't buy your story. I look at your trends and I model based on your trends, and I don't pay you for hockey stick projections that haven't happened yet. When I get into a business, I bend the growth curve. So I'm not selling Kool-Aid, you know, about what it might do someday. I'm selling what it's actually doing. And that's a new growth rate. And I find in every company I go into, if I walk into your company, you listener out there, I bet you I walk into your company today, I will find a lot of price available in your, you know, in your marketplace. I am very aggressive at pushing price. I am very aggressive at creating strategic pivots and tiering products and services. So let's go to roofing for a second. Roofing company puts out one bid. Why is it one bid? Why not good, better, best? Take your current one bid product, put it in the middle. Let's create something more expensive. I'm going up on your roof. I'm putting on, actually, I'm not because I use outsourced crews, but I'm a sales organization, but we're putting a new roof on your house. You really want me to take off old gutters and then put old gutters back up on a new roof? Of course you don't. You know, let's put new gutters on new roof. Hey, you've got a ridge vent. Let's put in a solar powered attic fan. I'm going to find, you know, you go to McDonald's. Would you like to supersize that? Would you like, you know, to add an apple pie? It's like, we need to perfect the art of cross-sell, upsell, you know, and we need to think about in terms of tiering the products and services, maximizing price potential in everything that we do. So many different ways to grow revenue and to grow earnings. I've got revenue. Can I service it more efficiently? Can we become more efficient in how we service revenue? You know, and how can I reinvent myself to be more streamlined in the servicing of my customers and servicing of my revenue so that I can increase profitability? It's like there's so many levers for growth that are out there that are left untapped.
So just to be clear, the four in that you talk about in the book are price, volume, pivoting, and tiering. And I you sort of alluded to, I think, mostly price and tiering there.
Okay, so volume. Better, best. Volume is, you know, my digital marketing strategy, my customer acquisition strategy. Some of these are interrelated. Price, can I get more price? Volume, if I'm a roofing company, can I get more roofs? But volume can also mean, you know, tiering and adding upsells and more category, you know, products, you know, to my initial offering. So price, volume, pivot is something simply like I look at my customer. The hardest thing for us to do in any of these companies is get a customer. Once I have them, what else can I sell them? You know, if I'm selling an HVAC system as an example, well, they only buy one every 10 or 15 years. Can I sell them a service contract with that? Can I sell them something that twice a year is going to get me inside that home when they don't need a new system? And maybe while I'm in there, it's like, hey, did you know that I can add, you know, HEPA air filtration or UV lighting? Or did you know that I can add a smoke detector inside your, because of how house fires spread? It's like, what else, you know, can I create an ancillary recurrent revenue stream that gives me more touch points with this customer I've already got? You know, hey, if I'm doing in HVAC and, you know, maybe I've expanded my product base to include some new products, you know, I can go back to all the customers that I've previously sold and offer them my new product and service. And so a strategic pivot is I look at the customer, I look left, I look right. What else do they buy that's kind of in my expanded, extended wheelhouse? And can I add new products and services? Because the hardest thing for me to do is acquire a customer. Once I have them, I want to sell them more stuff and I want to sell it more frequently, especially if I'm project-based, you know, doing something like HVAC or a roof where they only buy once every 15 years. I need other things to sell them. Otherwise, I've wasted the cost of the customer acquisition. Price, can I do whatever I'm doing and get more for it? Volume, can I redesign my sales effort in order to get more of it or get more efficient at closing it? You know, and then, you know, so price, volume, pivot, can I create new products and services? I'm a landscape mow and blow company. Now I'm doing landscape lighting, bed mulching, flower planting, holiday lighting, you know, and all of these things intertwined. If I have a strategy, if I have initiatives, if I have ownership within my organization, I can really drive a faster amount of growth. And so most of our companies are sleepy and we really just focus on one thing. Mm. And we have to think outside the box and think and get more creative than we've been to find these opportunities. I come into an organization, I find them every time.
I love that term, sleepy. And you're using this kind of rubric, these four, I'm sure, you know, there's probably other things that you get into too, but there's a pretty safe bet there's going to be a lot of leverage, a lot of margin, a lot of growth available in one or a few of these four.
And some levers give me more traction faster than others, but these are my standard plays in my playbook every time.
Okay. We got to get you out of here on time. So I have a fun question to close, Adam. You are a young and growth hungry entrepreneur with visions of one day becoming an 8-figure business owner. Now, here's some bad news here. One night, a magic genie wearing Pit Viper sunglasses, jean shorts with no shirt and bright purple Crocs. I'm not sure why any of that's relevant, but that's just what he's wearing. Purple Crocs for footwear. And sporting the sexiest mullet you've ever seen, arrives at your door with some news. He says, Adam, I've been asked by our creator to come and take away your business skills, all of them, except for two. You can keep two. Which two are you keeping and why?
So define skills. But if I think of it in terms of, you know, so I would like to think I'm a very effective communicator.
Let me define skills. It's like core competencies. It's like things that you're like exceptionally good at. Natural gifts that are baked in or learned through reps, but things that you just have in your core.
Yeah. So there's two things I think that are most important to me. If I want to build a big company, I need people. And so in order to attract people, I have to be able to create and articulate a vision for a, you know, create shared aspirations around future growth. I've got to be able to motivate a team of people and get them to overachieve. So I think culture is critical in any business that we're going to build on a large scale. We're going to need people. I need to be able to motivate people to get them to work hard for me. So being an inspirational leader, you know, being someone that can articulate the vision, communicate, that's a skill I must have. It's foundational to building a successful empire. You know, I would tell you that I'm as I get old, I'm getting lazy, meaning I'm more efficient with time. You know, if I think about my expertise in life, $2.5 billion in exits, the majority of that profit came from the skill set known as buy and build. My ability to find good companies, pay fair market values, talk those entrepreneurs into joining me in my mission to revolutionize an industry. I put those two, if I can maintain those two things, you can strip everything away. And this is a fun exercise, by the way. I've done this, you know, with coaching clients where, you know, I have a peer group, 38 people, and they're in a room and I say, you know what? Somebody with that mullet just took away all of your money. You're starting from zero. You know, and I break them up into groups. What kind of business are you going to start? You know, what's it going to be called? Build a business plan, you know, and then let's evaluate, you know, and so, you know, you can take away the success, you can take away the money. If you know how to create a business, doesn't matter what industry, you know, you pull all that away, you'll be successful again, you know, in a different industry, in a different time period. So for me, motivate people, you know, the experience around talking people into partnering with me, doing buy and build mergers and acquisitions, I could build a really big company really quick with those two skills.
I love it. Adam, you've been an amazing guest. Where can people connect with you? Where can people learn more about the work you do? Get your books. Just give us a bit of a digital footprint to follow you on your journey.
Yeah, books are on Amazon. You'll find me on LinkedIn. It's the only social media platform I'm on. Believe it or not, there's a fake Adam on Facebook, on Instagram. There's a fake Adam on Instagram with 10,000 followers. Ugh. You know, I tell Meta, it's like hell. It's like they get taken down, someone new pops up. You'll find me on LinkedIn. Why? Because I'm a business guy. I work with business owners, and that's where there's 800, million business people. So I'm there, adamecoffee.com, chairmangroup.us. You know, it's like you'll find my books on Amazon or anywhere books are sold, but you'll get me on LinkedIn. I don't have a team of, social media people. I respond to everybody that reaches out to me. I enjoy engaging with people, and this has been fun. So I appreciate you having me on, and best of luck to all your listeners out there.
Thanks, Adam. Take care.
Bye now.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.